an enormous amount of very exciting things going on in the past couple years, in the past year, in understanding all these amazing properties of amplitudes better and better. And so one thing that we got great control of last year is the planar integrand of n equals 4 super Young Mills in the in the integrand of n equals 4 super Young Mills amplitudes in the planar limit. And so we have that in principle to all loop order determined recursively, and it's in a way that makes the Yangian invariance of the theory manifest at the level of the integrand. And anyway, there's lots of developments associated with that. The next obvious natural step is to try to learn how to do the integrals and make connections to all the various other things that have been going on involving OPEs and integrability in some way. And there's been lots of terrific work being done on that recently. My focus is going to be to continue to try to understand the structure of this object, of this integrand, as transparently and cleanly, as simply as possible. In this business, it's always paid off to try to understand the simple things in the deepest and the best possible way. Because once you understand them very well, then all of a sudden you can do a huge number of things that you couldn't do before. And I really think really understanding exactly what this object is and what it's trying to tell us will tell us the natural way to integrate it and extract the actual polylogs and things like that that we're interested in. Anyway, that's a separate story. It's definitely intrinsically interesting in itself to try to understand this thing better. And at least in part of the story, the what seems to be behind a lot of this structure is this this correspondence, at first very surprising seeming correspondence between a contour integral in the Grassmannian on the left, and the so somehow this object has lots of magical properties, and we can from it extract the all loop planar integrand of the theory in a straightforward way. So this is some integral on the left. This is some integral. I'll talk more about it. This is some integral. The integrand is some integrand on the right. And if we want to ask the simplest question about the integrals, then we can do the integrals on the simplest possible contours, which compute residues instead of trying to compute them on more physical contours. We can try to compute residues. If we compute residues of the planar integrand, so these are just doing the good old-fashioned usual Feynman diagram calculations, but instead of doing the loop integrations from minus infinity to infinity, you integrate them over compact contours that encirculate the singularities of the integrand. Then that object on the right-hand side are known as the leading singularities of amplitudes. The leading singularities are really computed. Leading singularities are computed by drawing things that look just like loop diagrams. Since we have to hunt for singularities of the loop integrand. And the only, so if we have we have some sum of a whole bunch of Feynman, however we want to compute and get the integrand, we know in the end that all of its singularities involve putting internal particles on shell. And so computing the residues of that integrand corresponds to drawing pictures like this and even more and more complicated pictures at higher and higher loop orders. But instead of integrating over these momenta, over all possible values off shell, instead cutting them and computing the residue on shell. So this is something, the leading singularities of amplitudes are something that even if you didn't someone didn't hand you the actual amplitude with all the polylogs and so on. It's something that you could compute just using the tree-level data of the theory. And you compute it by drawing things that look like loop diagrams. But all the vertices are on-shell objects, on-shell tree amplitudes. And then instead of, as I said, instead of integrating over all the momenta, you just cut all the intermediate lines. So it's a very close cousin of the loop integral. In fact, it is the loop integral, but done on a different contour. Not the contour from minus infinity to infinity, but on a whole bunch of contours that encircle all the different possible singularities you could have. And so, so these leading singularities are a data that's associated with the scattering amplitude to all loop order. And it's data that you can get without actually computing all the loop amplitudes. You can just get it by drawing these pictures, more and more complicated pictures, hooking them all up together, and just computing the function that you get in the end. So this is a function of the external data. It's a function of all the external momenta. And it's clear it's going to be, in general, an algebraic function of the external variables. It's algebraic because it can have square roots, and square roots is square roots, and cube roots, and so on. Because we have to solve these polynomial equations, all these quadratic equations that put these internal loop momenta to zero in general. That some of the very simple ones will be rational functions, but in general, they're algebraic functions of the external data. And so that's one suite of objects that you can compute in any quantum field theory, in particular, n equals 4 superangulars. Okay? So we can compute it without knowing the full loop amplitude. So in principle, there's this big list of rational functions. And if you're very naive, you would think that, well, there's an enormous number of these guys. You know, even if we talk about the very simplest amplitudes, the MHV amplitudes, let's say, then I could draw one loop leading singularities, two loop leading singularities, 100 loop leading singularities, 1,000 loop leading singularities. And on the face of it, there would just be more and more and more complicated functions of the external variables. Like I said, they're not combinatorially less complicated than the loop diagrams. They're exactly as combinatorially as complicated as loop diagrams, just we're doing them on different contours. That's one suite of objects, the leading singularities of any quantum field theory, in particular, n equals 4. I should have said that that the way you identify what the leading singularities are if someone did hand you the amplitude is the leading singularities are the things that are the coefficients of the polylogs. Okay, so if someone handed you the whole amplitude, it would have polylogs, but what sits in front of the polylogs are the leading singularities. And the reason is that cutting all of these internal propagators corresponds to finding more and more and more discontinuities of the object directly as the amplitude. And if you take enough discontinuities of the polylogs, eventually you get these, the transcendental piece goes away, and you just have these coefficients that sit in front of them that are algebraic. So those are two ways of talking about the leading singularities. If someone handed you the whole amplitude magically, there would be the coefficients of the transcendental pieces. And even if they didn't hand them to you, you could compute them by yourself by drawing these very high loop, complicated looking loop diagrams, but putting all the internal lines on shell. That's one suite of objects. So instead of being transcendental functions, they're just algebraic functions, close cousins. They're algebraic functions of the external data. Now, the claim is that those algebraic functions of the external data are in one-to-one correspondence with the residues of this contour integral over the Grassmannian. Completely different object, seems to have nothing to do with this picture of loop diagrams and spacetimes and cutting and none of that stuff. Instead, it's just some integral over k-planes and dimensions. Originally, it was a conjecture that all the leading singularities are there, and now that conjecture is proven. Maybe I'll mention a little bit what the proof looks like. But anyway, it's a second object which is computing exactly the same suite of algebraic functions. And so that's the equivalent. Now, one thing that you should have expected on the right-hand side is whatever these functions are should enjoy all the symmetries of the theory, whatever they are, unencumbered by infrared divergences. Because we're precisely doing the loop integrals on the contours on which they're perfectly well-defined, right, on just encircling poles. So these leading singularities, apart from everything else, contain expose naturally all the symmetries that the theory wants to have, which aren't obscured by infrared divergences. So, of course, we expect that this theory has this infinite dimensional Yangian symmetry. The claim is that this object on the left computes all the leading singularities. And in fact, its real point in life, as we now understand, is that this thing, all the residues of this integral actually give you all possible Yangian invariants. Here I'm talking about the free Yangian invariants, ignoring the collinear subtleties. All Yangian invariants are residues of this integral. Now, beyond that, these leading singularities, when computed from quantum field theory, satisfy lots of interrelationships between each other. Those interrelationships between each other are consequences of locality and unitarity, ultimately. Okay. So locality and unitarity are imprinted in the leading singularities in the existence of lots of linear relations that are satisfied between this suite of algebraic objects. These are highly non-trivial identities that if you didn't know they came from a quantum field theory, locality and unitarity, and someone just handed you these identities, seem like very strange identities. Okay, so on the left-hand side, these identities are consequences of residue theorems in this big, this is to be interpreted as a big complex contour integral, and there's consequences of residue theorems in that object. The most striking thing, perhaps the most striking thing of all, there are many striking things, but this is certainly a striking thing, is this equivalence makes something obvious on this side, which is completely unobvious from the quantum field theory side. Okay. Of course, the fact that there's Yangian invariance is totally unobvious from the Lagrangian. But something less fancy than Yangian invariance, but in a sense even more striking, is that you see, if I hand you all these leading singularities, it looks like there's an infinite number of them. You just go to higher and higher loop order, you get more and more and more complicated functions. Even for the simplest MHV amplitudes, 100 loop, 200 loop, you just draw the diagrams, they look like more and more and more complicated things. But on the left-hand side, there's no loop. Where's L? There's no loop order in the left-hand side at all. In fact, the left-hand side makes something completely obvious, which is that a given value of the number of particles and a given number of K, the number of negative Felicity gluons, there's a finite set of objects, completely finite set of objects, that can ever appear as leading singularities. That means that if you compute them, you go to higher and higher loop orders, at some point you stop running out of new objects. Okay? You just keep getting the same objects over and over again. It's totally unobvious from Feynman diagrams from field theory. Okay? For example, for MHV tree amplitude, the only object you ever get is the MHV tree amplitude and nothing else. Okay? So the algebraic function that you could in principle get is just the MHV tree amplitude and nothing else. So, yes, that's right. Sorry? True, definitely. Sorry? No, I mean, it's just a statement that you run out of new objects as you go to high loop orders, which actually is I think intimately connected to the theory having a nice strongly coupled limit. If as you went to higher and higher loop order, you had more and more complicated rational functions or algebraic functions sitting in front of the polylogs, it sounds impossible for that to resum into something nice that's strong coupling. But since you have this finite set of objects, you have this finite set of objects that are addressed by more and more complicated polylogs, then it seems reasonable that they resum into something. Anyway, this is the sort of zeroth order story that we've been talking about for a couple of years and understanding better and better. But something that you might wonder is where the heck does this come from? I mean, where does this? Why is there this Grassmannian here? Why is there this funny measure involving the product of all these cyclic minors? I mean, I'll talk about it in some more detail in a second. But where does this whole structure come from? Why is it Yangian invariant? Okay. I mean, if you'd never heard of Yangian invariant, why would you even bother checking? Is it Yangian invariant? Where does any of it come from? Okay. Okay. Now, that's what I want to talk about on Tuesday. So I'm giving a talk at the conference next week. And the purpose of the talk on Tuesday is to tell you where the structure comes from. I think we don't understand all of it, but we're starting to understand a lot of it. And there is some beautiful underlying geometry. It's associated with some subspace of the Grassmannian that just so happens to have been studied by mathematicians just in the last decade or so. It's not very well explored by them, but there's a particular geometric part of the Grassmannian known as the positive part or the non-negative part of the Grassmannian, and this geometry is behind all of this. In particular, once you explore this part of the Grassmannian, a huge number of things are emergent. The existence of a cyclic structure at all is emergent. The existence of this funny measure, this measure is the unique and only measure you can write down, which is non-singular on the positive part of the Grassmannian with singularities on the boundary. This object is a polytope that lives in the Grassmannian of a very beautiful and intricate with a very beautiful and intricate structure, which is again completely emergent. The space. The question you ask is an extremely elementary question, but the answer has all of this. The answer is this wonderful structure in it. The residues, all the Yangian invariants, are associated with the faces of this polytope. The relations between all of them are associated with going to a one higher dimensional face in this polytope and summing over all the one lower dimensional faces of all of them and getting zero. So it's a boundary. The boundary equals zero statement. Understanding this structure also helps us to begin to see how we can think about the loop integrand, which at the moment has been thought of as an integral in the end over space-time, but the integral over space-time has an image as an integral inside the Grassmannian. We can think about the loop integral actually for a lower particle amplitude as integrating over all the ways we can embed lower k-planes in lower n dimensions and the higher k-planes in n dimensions. And I suspect that's going to be very useful for actually thinking about how to do the integrals ultimately. And it's also allowed us just to generate enough data to start asking questions beyond the planar limit. And if I have time on Tuesday, I'll tell you some of the things that we're starting to understand beyond planarity. But since that's all the stuff that I want to talk about Tuesday, the organizers here were kind enough to let me cheat a little bit to get extra time for Tuesday to just talk about the very, very basic part of the story. So this is the now by now quite old part of the story. So I don't have to review that on Tuesday. I will talk about it now. Sure.
You didn't write specifically the integral. I'm trying to understand where the Grassmannian is coming from. So, the ambient space.
Yes.
Yeah,
this is exactly what I'm about to talk about. So I'm really going to go, yes, but the ambient space is not the sum of the limit. It's just the, if you have n particles, there's an n-dimensional space. This is literally what I'm just about to start talking about. So if I don't answer your question in 5 minutes, sure, no problem.
Subspaces are determined by the element.
No, so... This is literally what I'm about to talk about right now. So n is the number of particles. K is the number of negative helicity gluons. Okay, so that's that data. And these delta functions are forcing the k-plane in n dimensions to contain certain planes and be orthogonal to certain other planes. Okay, and those are related to momentum conservation. So that's what I will just talk about right now. Right. No, it's completely bosonic. The slash is only to take care of the external data. It's an integral over a completely bosonic Grassmannian. Yeah. In fact, so roughly speaking, very roughly speaking, we'll talk about it. But after we get used to this basic object, you'll see that all the action is happening inside the Grassmannian. And then this thing is just the way to extract physics out of it. It's the window into this. It's a window into the Grassmannian that gives you functions of external data that we interpret in terms of scattering amplitudes. But everything, the geometry, the dynamics, if you like, is all taking place inside. It's sort of simple projective geometry inside the Grassmannian is determining everything about the amplitudes. So, but. If I really don't, if this isn't crystal clear in 5 minutes, stop me and I'll say it again. Okay, so, all right, so anyway, so today is the complete basics. The five people in the audience who are experts on this subject should feel free to go to sleep. Okay, so let's back way the heck up from all of this. And just see why any kind of Grassmannian is going to make an appearance at all. Why would you even think about Grassmannians? So in order to do that, I just want to think about the external data. So the external data, let's forget about supersymmetry for a second as well. Okay? We have some lambdas and some lambda tildes for all of the external particles. So these have a Lorentz index A and A dot. So A runs from 1 to N. N is the number of external particles. All right. Now, I just want to think about this external data in a slightly funny way. Let's just draw what they look like in an n-dimensional space, where n is the number of particles. Okay. So the top component, the first Lorentz component of this, is some n-dimensional vector in this n-dimensional space, just n variables. Right. So the top component of this guy is some n-dimensional vector in this n-dimensional space. So if you like, this is lambda A equals 1. And here is lambda A equals 2. Okay. In a particular Lorentz frame, that's what it looks like. But remember that Lorentz transformations act like as SL2 on the lambdas. So in a different frame, the vectors will be different, but the plane that's spanned by the vectors will be the same. So the Lorentz invariant data is the plane. It's a two-dimensional plane that lives in n dimensions. So already, a Grassmannian is making an appearance just in terms of the external data, nothing else. Okay? The external data is specified by giving a two-plane, let's call this a lambda two-plane in n dimensions. And there's some other lambda tilde two-plane in n dimensions. So this is a Lorentz invariant way of thinking about all of the external data. There's a lambda plane, and there's a lambda tilde plane. Okay. Now, the space of k-dimensional planes in n dimensions is the Grassmannian GK, n. So a point in the Grassmannian is a particular k-plane, and so we see that the external data is given by specifying a point in one G2n and another point in some other G2n. So one for lambda and one for lambda tilde. Now, I drew these planes in this particular way because they're actually orthogonal to each other. And they're orthogonal to each other as a consequence of momentum conservation. Momentum conservation is actually the statement that these planes are orthogonal to each other, right? Because it's just that the sum over A, lambda tilde A and A dot is equal to 0. So that means any vector in this plane is orthogonal to any vector in the other plane, so the two planes are orthogonal to each other. So already, purely the structure of the external data and the fact that the Lorentz group is SL2 across SL2 tells you that it's natural to think about k-planes in n dimensions. At least two planes in n dimensions are just what labels the external data. Okay. All right, so a way of motivating, and this is just pure motivation, but just gives a little more understanding for what this formula is to let me go back to this picture. Now let me suppress one dimension. So here's the lambda tilde plane, and here's the lambda plane. And so you see, in this language, momentum conservation is something a little bit exciting. It's not trivial. This language, momentum conservation is a quadratic constraint on the external data. So that's fine. I mean, part of the whole ideology here is to get the scattering amplitudes without unitarily evolving through the middle of the spacetime. So if you're going to get them flat out somehow, without evolving through a spacetime, it's not surprising that momentum conservation will be a non-trivial thing. Because momentum conservation is normally trivial because we see the translations inside the spacetime. Okay? But if from some other, if you're going to get the same objects from some other point of view, it's not surprising that it's going to be a much more non-trivial statement. Okay, so now what we're going to do, so now this is just the kinematics, but now we're going to start making, we're going to start playing. We're going to say that we're going to try to interpret where this quadratic constraint comes from, not directly as a quadratic constraint between lambda and lambda tilde, but as a pair of linear relations. Okay. So we're going to introduce a third object, and we're going to make lambda and lambda tilde both have some relationship to this third object, such that together they imply that lambda and lambda tilde are orthogonal. Okay. We're just going to do that for a fun. I could skip this whole part of the discussion and just directly go to this formula, but I just want to spend 5-10 minutes talking about it because it I think helps more intuitively understand where this thing comes from. Also, it helps very easily in understanding why this object is both conformal and dual conformal invariant. The object we'll eventually talk about. All right, so what we're going to do is introduce a third object, and the third object is going to be a general k-plane in n dimensions. So here's lambda, here's lambda tilde, and we're going to introduce a general object, call it ck, which is a k-dimensional plane in n dimensions. And geometrically, we're going to force that ck contains the lambda 2 plane, and ck is orthogonal to the lambda tilde 2 plane, the way I've drawn it. So I'm just going to impose that constraint. Clearly, if I do that, it forces lambda and lambda tilde to be orthogonal to each other. Okay. Now let's get a few things, very trivial things, out of the way. Note that this is impossible if k equals 0 or 1. There's obviously no points or line that contains the lambda 2 plane. That's good because the amplitudes vanish for k equals 0 and 1. When we interpret the k as the k that goes in the amplitudes, the number of negative helicity gluons, that's good. Those objects are supposed to vanish. Okay? So this is a trivial geometric way of seeing that. Also, it looks like this is distinguishing lambda from lambda tilde, which would be bad because flipping lambda and lambda tilde is parity. But actually, it isn't. This is a completely parity invariant statement. I can say it in a parity invariant way by remembering that paired with this k-plane is a natural orthogonal complement, n minus k-plane. And it's a statement that this n minus k-plane is orthogonal to lambda and contains lambda tilde. So parity is actually perfectly fine, but it involves interchanging the k-dimensional plane with its naturally paired orthogonal complement, n minus k-dimensional plane. Okay, so this now isn't just doing momentum conservation anymore. We're now starting to make a guess for some new formulas. We introduce this third object, we're going to start doing something with it. Okay, so let's just try to say this picture in equations. So in order to introduce the k-plane, how do I talk about a k-plane in n dimensions? Well, I have to give you k n-dimensional vectors who span this k-plane. Okay? So here is the first one, c1, c2, ck. So this whole thing is grouped into a k by n matrix that I'll call c alpha a. Okay, so this is a k by n matrix. Alpha is going to run from 1 to k, and a, as usual, runs from 1 to n. Okay? So if I hand you a k by n matrix, from that I can read off a k-plane in n dimensions. However, if it's really about the k-plane rather than the k-vectors individually, whatever I do with this k-plane had better be invariant under any k by k linear transformation that I do on the left here, right? Because I want it to just be a statement about the plane. So anything I do with the C alpha A had better be invariant under a gauge symmetry or a gauge redundancy here which is C alpha A goes to any K by K linear transformation on C. Okay? So there's a GLK gauge redundancy. So we can then use this to count the dimension of the Grassmannian. There's K times N variables, but there's minus K squared from this redundancy, so this is K times N minus K, the dimension of GKN, which of course is the same as the dimension of GN minus KN. And that's exactly this pairing between K planes and N minus K planes that we alluded to. Something you can do to be very concrete, and these give you coordinates on at least one part of the Grassmannian, is to, for example, use this K by K freedom to put any K of the columns to some orthonormal form, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and so on. For example, I could put the first K to that form, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and then 0, 0, 1, and then the remaining guys is K times N minus K variables here. Okay, so that's how we talk. So that labels a point in the Grassmannian. And now I want to impose that picture. So let me try to write that picture in equations. So the part where it's orthogonal to lambda tilde is easy. So I just say, so I have a product of alpha equals 1 to k. Okay, so that means that it's orthogonal to lambda tilde. Now I want to say that it contains lambda. So contains lambda is the easiest way is if we could look at the k by n matrix and see that the top two rows of this k by n matrix were just exactly the lambdas. If it was that, it would be obvious that it contains the lambda point. But of course, we could do a general K by K linear transformation, right? So what we should do is actually hunt around and see if we can find a linear combination of these K vectors such that it's equal to the lambda, plane. So that's what we do. We just integrate so this has a Lorentz index. So we integrate over all possible linear combinations of the C's and ask, is there a linear combination of the C's that's equal to the lambdas? Well, this Lorentz index there. So having done that, let me suppress the Lorentz index just so we don't have 100 things floating around. But but this is a delta squared. All right, so now this is just done in equations, what we see in the picture. Okay. Yeah. Oh, sorry, product over all the A's. Okay. But we can actually see that there's something wrong. The reason is that this looks like it's enforcing the picture, but it isn't quite, because this thing is not invariant under GLK transformations on the C's. In fact, it's just not invariant under the G part of GLK, just rescaling the C's. Okay. Let's see how much it's not invariant by. If I rescale C goes to TC, this first piece picks up a T to the negative 2K. Okay. Now, what does this do? If I rescale C, well, I can make up for it by rescaling W, but then I pick up another T to the negative 2K. So it's not invariant. So this distributional picture is not really a statement about the K-plane. It has some residual memory of the overall scale. All right, it's very simple to solve that problem. There's many ways of doing it, but the simplest way of doing it is to introduce four fermionic variables. So if we introduce delta 4, product over alpha, and now a delta 4 of C alpha A, eta tilde A, and there are four of these guys, okay? Then that gives us exactly the opposite Jacobian, T to the plus 4K, and that's great. Okay? So this is the motivation for supersymmetry from this point of view. Make it supersymmetric so we can talk about K-planes. And actually, algebraic geometers love odd variables for this reason. Okay, it makes it very easy to talk about, really for precisely this reason. They don't necessarily say it in exactly the same language, but this is now allowing us to geometrically talk about planes, which satisfy these properties. They contain something, they're orthogonal to something else. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, it's the usual delta 0 slash 4. It's the usual polynomial in the eta's of fourth order. Okay, great. So, fine. So let's. So we have this new object that's now supersymmetric. It wouldn't surprise you that we're now talking about n equals 4 super Yang Mills. But it still looks a little bit funny. So in order to we can even see a little more already here. If you just see how this object, what weights it has, if you rescale the lambdas and the lambda tildes and the eta's appropriately, you see that we're talking about gluons. So this is supersymmetric gluons, actually. Okay? But we can do a little bit more and see very manifestly this object is also superconformal invariant. And to see that it's superconformal invariant, it's easiest to go into twister space. So to go to twister space for any function of lambda and lambda tilde, we're just going to Fourier transform with respect to lambda. Let's just for simplicity imagine that everything is real in this step. Really, this is just helping us see something kinematical. Okay. So if you're not familiar with this half Fourier transform, ask me about it later. But what it does is take this thing to a function of mu tilde, lambda tilde. If there are some eta tildes here as well, they also go along for the ride. And these group into a super twister W, where W is exactly this mu tilde, lambda tilde, eta tilde. It's very easy to see that what this half Fourier transform does is really just linearize all of the superconformal transformations. So they're all just act as SL4 on the W variable. So that's really its point in line. Okay. All right. All right. So this is the general half Fourier transform. But if we do it here, we see something incredibly simple. Okay. So if we do the integral over the lambdas, well, the delta function just localizes it. We can do the integral over the rows, and well, it's just trivial to see that what we get from here is a product of alpha equals 1 to k, delta squared, so there's the original piece, lambda tilde a. Okay. There's also let me put it here, delta 4 with the eta tildes. But the remaining guy just turns into another delta squared of c alpha a mu tilde a. Yes. No. Oh, I'm sorry. This is 1 to k here as well. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. This have to make up the t to the minus 4k. So there are four variables here, so you get an overall 4k from that. Okay. All right. So that's just what you get from trivially doing the Fourier transform with respect to lambda. And so you see that this is nothing other than the product of alpha equals 1 to k, delta 4 slash 4, C alpha A, W A. Okay. So this makes it manifest that this picture with the planes containing each other and all that stuff is really something superconformal invariant in twister space. Going to twister space makes it manifestly superconformal invariant. And it's just the simplest possible thing you could have, right? It's just the super orthogonality of the K-plane with the 4-plane of W's in twister space. All right, so as I said, I could have skipped everything because this looks simple already, but I wanted you to see what this object, just purely kinematic object, means. What it corresponds to back in momentum space is this picture associated with momentum conservation. Okay, great. So that's the dependence on the external data, but of course, for general K, there are going to be many C's many k-planes that contain lambda and are orthogonal to lambda tilde. So we should obviously integrate over them. So now we want to, so we have this. This is the dependence on the external world. And now we want to integrate over all the c's. Okay, so how do we integrate over the c's? Well, we have to integrate over, so we can integrate over all the k by n variables. We have to remember to mod out by the GLK. In practice, there's no funny Fadeyev Popov crapola here. You can just fix, to 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, and then it's just literally an integral over the remaining variables. Okay? And you can do it any other gauge that you want. Okay? Right? But again, we're stuck. Because this is not GLK invariant. Once again, it's not GLK invariant because it's not invariant under the G part of GLK. When I rescale the C, the measure picks up K times N. Right? If I rescale C to TC, then we pick up a T to the K times N from here. So we have to have something that makes up these weights. Now, what could it be? I need to have K times N C's downstairs somehow. But minimally, whatever I do has to be SLK invariant with them. So the only way I can build SLK invariants is if I take this K by N matrix, I can take K of the columns, and I can just take their determinant. So that's a minor of this K by K matrix. If I pick the elements M1 through MK, so if this is epsilon alpha 1 up to alpha K, C alpha 1 M1 up to C alpha K MK, right? Then this is something which has weight. It has weight K under this rescaling. And so what I need to do to make an invariant measure is have something that has N of these minors downstairs in net somehow. Okay? So at this level, there's a million things that you could do. But keeping in mind that we have something of interest with amplitudes, we want there to be a cyclic structure associated with the amplitudes. So if we want this measure to have a cyclic, to have a natural cyclic symmetry, then there is clearly a completely simplest possible measure. And this is the simplest possible measure. You pick some minor, let's say by convention, just 1, 2 up to k, and then you just multiply by all of its cyclic friends. So we have to put n of them downstairs. This thing is now GLK invariant. Okay, so this whole thing is now GLK invariant. And so that's the part inside the Grassmannian. And the dependence on the external world is just what we had before. Okay. So from this argument, I'm repeating, as I said, by now, very, very old ways of motivating these things. On Tuesday, we'll understand where this all comes from an orthogonal point of view, where all this is forced on you and there's no choices being made. But it's certainly the aesthetically nicest choice. Okay? Now, of course, it's a little more than aesthetics. Something that you can easily see, if you put any measure there, this object is superconformal invariant. There's some argument that any superconformal invariant is actually an integral over the Grassmannian. It's not so easy to write things that are superconformal invariant. The super part is not non-trivial. So any superconformal invariant, I mean, as a function of these, in the representation we use for on-shell amplitudes, any superconformal invariant is an integral over the Grassmannian with some measure. But this measure is not only aesthetically the simplest, it's the one that guarantees that the answer is Yangian invariant. Okay. Now, there's a way of seeing, so perhaps before going to that, I should just say, how do we interpret this object? Well, you can immediately, so this form is just useful for seeing that this object is superconformal invariant. But if you don't want to work in twister space, you can immediately go back to momentum space if you like. Then it's just what we talked about before. And then you can just, then then you just use the delta functions to solve for a bunch of these to solve for a bunch of the C's. Basically, you have this K-plane that contains lambda and is orthogonal to lambda tilde. So the total number of degrees of freedom you actually have to move it around, the total number of degrees of freedom after on the support of those delta functions is it contains the lambda plane. So there's only K minus two directions are free. And then those K minus two directions should be orthogonal to both lambda and lambda tilde. So this is the dimensionality of K minus two planes in N minus four dimensions, just to do the counting. And this number is K minus two times N minus K minus two. Okay. So in the end, this object is a that many dimensional integral. Okay. And what you do is you interpret it as a contour integral, and you do anything you want with it. We compute residues, for example, and then all the claims I made before about are associated with that guy. Right? All right. But let me at least sketch the argument why this thing is obviously Yangian invariant. First, why would you even think, again, why would, if you'd never heard of Yangian invariance, why would you even think of checking for it? This geometric picture begs you to do something. This geometry begs you to do something because you look at this picture and you say, well, I'm really doing something very dumb here. I'm integrating over all k-planes which contain lambda and are orthogonal to lambda tilde. But since they're forced to contain lambda, why am I doing the integral over k-planes in n dimensions? Two of the dimensions are locked to be the lambda direction. Why don't I write it just as integral over k minus two planes in n dimensions directly? Okay. That's a very natural question. Of course, those k minus two planes should be orthogonal to lambda, right? But why can't I write it like that? Well, of course you can. You can trivially use these delta functions to put the top two rows of this C matrix to be the lambda plane. And you could do that no matter what the measure was. Okay? But the rub is that if you do it with a random measure, you can't interpret the resulting integral really as an integral over, honestly, k minus two planes in n dimensions. The reason is that the measure is a function of the minors of the big k by n matrix. And what you'd like it to be is a function of the minors of the little k minus two n by n matrix. And if you have a random measure upstairs, that will not happen. But something magical happens with this measure. With this measure, you start with this big k by n matrix, and somehow you want to you want to write the determinants of this big k by n matrix in terms of the little k minus two n by matrix. And if you're old enough, you were taught actually how to compute determinants in high school by hand. There is a high school trick for computing determinants just by taking linear combinations of enough rows upstairs to put a bunch of guys zero in the top row. If you do that trick, of course, you can take any one minor and reduce it to something upstairs times the product of the lower one. But again, that won't happen for all of them. However, with this measure, it happens for all of them. And so if you just follow through this argument, uniquely with that measure, you find that the original integral over k planes in n dimensions reduces to an integral over k minus two planes in n dimensions. Let me call those new matrices D. You get the minors of this lower k minus two dimensional matrix. And what you get here, just inherited from the delta functions inherited from this picture, but because of the linear transformation I had to do to relate this high school trick linear transformation, does a linear transformation on the lambda tildes, such that the resulting object precisely has the same form as the original thing that we started with, but where these z's are the momentum twister variables. it's a very simple argument, but I don't want to go through the algebra here. But basically, the geometry asks you to try to do this. For a general measure, you're obstructed. But for this special measure, you can do it. And what you find, remarkably, is exactly the same object, but you even invented the momentum twister variables along the way. The linear transformation just forces you to go from the lambdas and lambda tildes to the momentum twister variables. Sorry? No, it is not GLN invariant. It is not the standard measure on the whatever. Well, on Tuesday, you'll see in what sense it's a standard measure. But it's not the standard measure on the Grassmannian. It is the standard measure on the positive part of the Grassmannian. But that's what we'll talk about on Tuesday. Well, there was no standard measure on the positive, but it should be called the standard measure on the positive part of the Grassmannian. That's what it is. Okay. But, oh, sorry, and I forgot to say, this, of course, factors out momentum conservation and the super part of momentum conservation. And when you follow everything perfectly, as a Jacobian, comes out the whole Park Taylor factor. So this is precisely the correspondence between twister space and momentum twister space and everything. So in this way, just this simple geometry makes it clear the object we're talking about is conformally invariant and dual conformal invariant at the same time. And so is Yangian invariant. And it makes clear the special form, the special role played by these miners. Now there's a very, very, very nice argument that you heard about maybe earlier this week, just directly starting with this object in any one of these spaces and applying the Yangian generators to them and seeing that the Yangian generators acting on the W's turn into a differential operator acting on the C's, and that differential operator acting on the C's annihilates this linear combination, this particular measure. And that is, in fact, the unique measure that's annihilated by them is that guy. Okay, so that's a direct argument. If you had heard of the Yangian and you knew about these generators and you wanted to check, then you could check it like this. This picture lets you discover it if you'd never thought about it. And on Tuesday, we'll have a much more intrinsic geometric understanding for going the other way, why you would discover the Yangian starting from this underlying geometry. Just cyclic, dihedral, I guess. Okay. Yeah, so all these things that look funny, these cyclic minors, why cyclic, all of this stuff is what I'll talk about, is where this comes from on Tuesday. How am I doing for time? When did I start? Huh? Oh, okay. All right. Okay, so let me just say I forgot how long this takes to talk about. All right. So let me just give you a flavor of what some of the actually computing residues looks like. Okay. So the very simplest computation we can do is actually in momentum twister space. For NMHV, so it's K minus 2 is equal to 1. And then that's the case where these are just turned into 1 by 1 minors. So it's just, you can call it DD1 over D1 up to DDN over DN, delta 4/4 DAZA. Okay. And it's a 1 over GL1. So that's what we have to do. The very simplest case of all is the very simplest case of all is 5 particles. So let's just do the 5 first. And then the GL1 can be used to set any one of these Ds to 1. So that's the gauge fixing that we're doing. So we have an integral over 4 variables left. There are 4 bosonic delta functions here. And we can use those 4 bosonic delta functions to solve for all of these Ds. So, for example, if I set d5 to 1, this delta function is z5 plus d1 z1 plus d4 z4 is 0. And this is just saying that this four-dimensional vector can be expanded in the basis of any 4 four-dimensional vectors, so I can just solve for all the coefficients. And this object is the famous R invariant. So this is what we can call 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which is equal to delta 4 of a to 1. This is the fermionic component, 2, 3, 4, 5, plus cyclic over 1, 2, 3, 4 to 5, 1, 2, 3, where these angle brackets are just contracting all the bosonic guys with an epsilon tensor. Okay? So that's the simplest object. If you want to compute, if you want to do it for general n, you see, in order to be able to localize this integral, you have to put n minus 5 of these d's to 0. So that's the, I told you it's a residue integral, and this is a particularly trivial residue. You have to take n minus 5 of the variables and compute them around contours around where those d's vanish. Okay? And then having put them to 0, you solve for the rest of them, and you get a completely general a, b, c, d, e for any a, b, c, d, and e. So those are the general residues of this object for k equals 1. Okay, so this for people who have been in this business recently, thinking in momentum twisters is probably these things are very familiar. Slightly less familiar to most people is seeing some of these computations in the original twister space. And well, I think the in the end the things it's going to pay off to think about things in the original twister space. I promise you. But let's just do just a little example, just so you get a flavor of what it looks like. So let's go back to the original twister space, and now let's do the simplest MHV amplitude. So k equals 2. Just MHV. So this is just d2 times c, d2 times n over vol gl2, and then we have 1 over 1 2, 2 3 up to n1, and our delta 4 slash 4. C dot W. But remember, what this is really doing back in momentum space is enforcing that the two-plane C contains the two-plane lambda. So it's totally obvious what it is. It's localized completely. There's a unique C plane. There's a unique two-plane that contains lambda, namely lambda itself. And so what all we get is just the measure downstairs is just the standard Park-Taylor factors. So the C matrix just becomes exactly lambda 1, lambda 2, up to lambda n, and the measure just becomes Park-Taylor. Okay. All right. Now, already here we can see something. Even in this very trivial example, there's a useful way of thinking about where this residue is in the Grassmannian. Okay? So let's just think, how do I label this point in the, how do I see where this thing is in the Grassmannian? It's not too good, it's not very meaningful to actually just give this 2 by n matrix. The reason is that it's not invariant, it has little group weights under each one of the columns. Okay? So really what we have isn't the whole Grassmannian, it's the whole Grassmannian up to rescaling each column individually. So it's really a configuration of n points in a projective k minus one dimensional space after I factor out the little group on each guy. Right? So that's the invariant content. And so the invariant content with this is then just very simple. Even I started with a two-plane in four dimensions, I can rescale each column, so I'm talking about n points on a projective line. And so this general configuration is just n points on a projective line. So just n distinct points on a projective line. Okay, 1, 2, up to n. Let's do a super, super simple example explicitly. Sorry, what happened to my... Oh, wait, there it is. So that's the generic configuration. So let's say we're doing G24, and let me gauge fix so I have a 1 0 x2 y2 0 1 x4 y4. Okay, so let's say this is my C plane. So I said I could gauge fix any two columns. Let's say I do it like this. Okay, so then my measure is just dx2 dy2 dx4 dy4, and if I look at the product of these cyclic minors, I just get, you can very easily see that's y2, x2, x4. So it's just a product of all of them. In this case, it's so trivial. It's not normally this simple. But it's just x2, y2, x4, y4. Okay. Then I have the delta 4 C dot W or its analog in momentum space. Okay, and so in momentum space, on the support of the delta functions, we completely localized these x's, right? And so we're done. Okay, so there's no integral to be done. We don't have to compute a residue. You're done. Okay? However, no one said that we have to do this computation for generic external momenta. Okay? So just to get an idea, even a very simple idea of what some residues look like, let's take this integral, and I can do the x2 integral as a residue. Let's say I put x2 to 0. Let me do something. Let's say I put y2 to 0. Okay? If I put y2 to 0, then I'm left with dx2 over x2, dx4 over x4, dy4 over y4. Okay? But let's ask what that's done in my picture. So I started off having 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay? But after having put y2 to 0, you see, the new matrix I have has that zero. And so what does this mean in terms of those projective configurations? It means that the vector 2 is proportional to the vector 1. So that means that those points are projectively identified. Okay. So here's 1 and 2 on top of each other, and 3 and 4. Okay. This is a perfectly valid residue of this Grassmannian integral. What does it correspond to in momentum space? In momentum space, this is zero for generic momenta, but it's obvious what it's doing. It's only non-zero if 1 and 2 are parallel to each other, if lambda 1, lambda 2 vanishes. This is nothing other than the residue on the factorization channel of the four-particle amplitude, the holomorphic factorization channel where 1, 2 sit on top of each other. Okay? So you don't even have to compute these things for generic momenta. Okay? You just sit there in the Grassmannian, and you find the configurations in the Grassmannian that find you residues, right? Then you can just ask what they correspond to in momentum space. Some of them will be non-zero for generic external momenta. Some of them will force the external momenta to a singular configuration that correspond to factorization channels and other physical things. Okay? All right. So now let me show you the. I say this because. After a little bit, you spend all of your time. You don't even think about what's going on in momentum space or space-time. You spend all of your time staring at pictures like this. Projective points, what happens when two of them merge, you lose one of them. For example, I could go further. I could go further and compute the next one when x2 goes to 0. If I compute the next one where x2 goes to 0, that corresponds to something where 2 is just deleted as a point altogether. Okay? It's just gone, and so this is putting y2 to 0. If I further put x2 to 0, then I have just something where I just have 1, 3, and 4, for example. So that corresponds not just to the factorization limit of 2, but the soft limit entirely, removing 2 completely. Okay. We can do many other things. We can merge 3 and 4. We can merge 1, 2, and 3. And everything you do in this picture, everything you do that gives you a consistent picture for a residue on this side correspond to something meaningful in space-time. All right, let me do one more little example, then I'll start making general statements and wrap up, because I don't want to take completely long. So let's do an example in G3-6, the first non-trivial NMHV example. And so here already, the dimensionality of G3-6 is 9. This is 9-dimensional. But remember, on the support of the delta functions, we have k minus 2 times n minus k minus 2 variables, which is equal to 1 in this case, for k equals 3, n equals 6. So that means that if you want to have a residue that's non-zero for generic external momenta, you have a one-dimensional integral to do. So you have to take one residue you have to take this measure and take one residue on it. So let's do the simplest example, a simple example of what this looks like. So let's say I gauge fix this to be 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, and somewhere else here, I don't know, 0, 0, 1 for 4. This is x3, y3, z3, x5, y5, z5, x6, y6, z6. Okay, so I did it in this way so that we can do something very simple. When I look at the first minor, 1, 2, 3, that determinant is just as E3. Okay? So I have the integral over all the dx's, dx's, dy's, and dz's. But the very first thing I get from this first one is x3, and then I have the rest of them, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2. Okay? Z3. Okay? All right, so the first thing I can do then, one of the simplest residues I could take is just put Z3 equal to 0. Okay? Let's just look at that. Z3 is equal to 0. So I've got to compute this dz3 over z3. I'm going to put z3 to 0. And having put z3 to 0, what does this matrix look like? Well, just put a 0 there. Okay. So what does this look like as a configuration in the Grassmannian, or more properly, as a configuration of 6 points in a projective 2-dimensional space? Right? Okay, I can rescale each one of the columns. So each one of the columns corresponds to a point in a 2-dimensional projective space. Okay. Well, okay, this is some generic, 4 is some generic point here. 5 is some generic point here. So now, they're now living in a plane. 6 is some generic point here. But you see, the important point is that since there's a 0 down here, 3 is a linear combination of 1 and 2. Okay? So that means that 1, 2, 3 are on a line. So this residue corresponds to that kind of geometry in the Grassmannian. Okay? And you can find other residues. So all of them in this case are going to look like that. Okay? All the ones with just putting one guy to zero are going to look like that. I could have said this without gauge fixing. More invariantly, I take the minor 1, 2, 3, and I'm saying the minor 1, 2, 3 is 0. Well, that means that 1, 2, 3 are all collinear. So I could have said it like that directly. Okay. Now, as you start doing many examples, you start noticing a pattern that what these configurations look like can actually be characterized by saying, well, you see, in this case, I say 1, 2, 3 are collinear, 4, 5, and 6 are in general places. But there isn't a residue where 1, 2, 5 are collinear. Okay? The only ones are ones where consecutive guys. There's a relationship between consecutive guys. Okay? Now, this is a big, very big, important point that I'll talk about at some length on Tuesday. But this is the sort of zeroth order statement, is that all the residues of this integral are characterized by giving chains of linear relationships between k consecutive guys. Okay? That's a non-trivial statement. Okay? But that means that any residue is associated with a picture of a configuration of points in k-dimensional space where they satisfy relations that can be said in terms of collinearity, coplanarity, and et cetera, statements involving k consecutive particles at a time. Okay? So these cases are quite simple. But as you go to, you know, if you go to k equals 4, you can start getting quite intricate looking relationships with things like that. You know, 1, 2, 3 on a line, 4 is here, 5 and 6 are on that intersection, 7, 8, 9 are there, and so on. So you spend your time drawing pictures like that. But it's pictures like that which just give you this little linear algebra problem of giving linear dependency between k consecutive guys, or in one-to-one relationship between all the residues of this Grassmannian integral. And in fact, that's something I will, as I said, I'll talk about on Tuesday. How do you classify this? How do you think about it? What's the underlying geometry which is involved? Okay. So as you see, more and more. Already here, let me just do a little analog of the example we did here. What if I wanted to? I could put yet another minor to zero, or I could make a slightly more special configuration. For example, I could put 4 on this line, 1, 2, 3. Okay. That's one more constraint. So now, whatever this is not going to be non-vanishing for generic external momenta, and indeed, it corresponds to some factorization channel. Okay. Or I could put, I don't know why I drew it like that, or I could make push 4 so that 4, 5, 6 are also collinear. Okay? All of these pictures involving collinearities, all these pictures involving linear relationships between k consecutive guys map to residues of this Grassmannian integral, which in turn map to a leading singularity, which in turn maps to some space-time picture of what's going on. So everything that's going on in space-time is captured completely by this algebraic geometry inside the Grassmannian of this very particular sort. Okay. All right, so now finally let me at least make it plausible why all the leading singularities are actually captured by this Grassmannian integral. And then I'll, let's see. Yeah, this will just take me 5 minutes, and then I'll, then I'll stop. So remember, to build a picture for a leading singularity, we have to glue things together in a way that looks like it's a loop. But secretly, what we're doing is just integrating over the on-shell Lorentz invariant phase space of these intermediate guys. Okay? That operation is something that's amazingly simple and canonical. It translates to something simple and canonical in the Grassmannian. The easiest way of seeing that, so we could talk about a leading singularity like this, but this is just a slightly more complicated version of the simplest thing you can do, which is just glue two things together like that. So that would be just a sort of a correspond to a standard factorization channel. So if I'm doing this in space-time, if I'm doing this in momentum space, I would integrate over the lambdas and the lambda tildes, of course, modulo the GL1. So here's a lambda and a lambda tilde, negative lambda and lambda tilde, of the function on the left, it's a function of lambda and lambda tilde, and the function on the right, it's a function of lambda and lambda tilde. Okay? Now, quite beautifully and simply, this is extremely simple if you express all these things in twister space. It just turns into an integral. And if it was supersymmetric, I would have that. So it turns into just an integral over the, just a trivial Fourier transform. So this turns into an integral over F left of W, F right of W. Okay. So gluing things together in space-time with the on-shell invariant Delibes integral just corresponds to gluing them together in twister space in the only way you could possibly do it. Okay, so you identify the two W's and you integrate over them. But you see, this makes it incredibly simple to implement this procedure on using the Grassmannian. The reason is that F left is some integral over the C's on the left with some measure, whatever it is. But there's a delta 4/4 of C. So let me write what the C matrix would look like on the left. If I call this particle I, this is 1, 2, up to whatever. This is the rest of them. So, but I can always gauge fix so the column I is a 1, 0, 0, and whatever's going on in the rest of them is going on. And I have something similarly on the right. And similarly on the right, I can gauge fix it so it's 1, 0, 0 and everything else, I here. So in the delta function, this just tells me the only way WI makes an appearance is through delta 4/4 WI plus all the guys in this top row. Similarly, the only way W appears down here is through WI here plus all the guys in the top row. So it's utterly trivial to do the integral over the W's. You just use them using the delta functions. And the variables reassemble themselves into a new K by N matrix. So completely explicitly, you just copy and paste. You just take the two matrices, and then you remove one of the columns, you glue the rest of them together in this trivial way, and you get a new matrix that corresponds to the other guy. Okay? Now, this is a picture that you can draw completely regardless of what the measure is. It doesn't even matter what the measure is. Okay? This just shows that that the Grassmannian representation of superconformal invariants is particularly well suited to gluing things together on shell, and it gives you an idea why this. Well, anyway, it's just what I said. But actually, so, I mean, I said this algebraically, but it's very simple to see what it is geometrically. So just to pick a simple example, let's say we wanted to see, what gluing together a four-particle vertex on one side with MHV k equals 2 and another one on another side, 4, 5, 6, looks like. Well, this is k equals 2. So whatever it is on the left, it has the points 1, 2, 3, and I would be on the line. That's what I told you before. Whatever it is on the right, the points 4, 5, 6, and I prime would be on a line. But precisely, gluing them together is identifying via two I's. So all you do is you draw the picture and you make them intersect on the on the point, which now then loses significance, right? So for the underlying object, this is the localization that it has in the Grassmann. Okay, so this makes it very reasonable that you're going to put configurations together and you're going to get new configurations. The miracle is that with the measure that we have, when you put together the measures on the left and the right, what you get is the correct measure for this guy, so that it's, again, a residue of the appropriate object in G36. That is far from obvious, and it's not true for any measures, but it is true for the measure that we're talking about. And so you see, this is indeed a factorization channel, exactly as I told you. It's one of the examples that we just talked about a second ago, where I made four collinear with five and six. So in fact, this is part of a more general statement that there's a suite of extremely simple operations that you can do on these invariants. You can glue them together, you can add a particle, you can subtract a particle. There's very simple tinker toy operations that is very easy to understand, that it maps invariants to invariants. And so that's, well, after you think about it properly, it's very easy to understand it maps invariants to invariants. And that's why, that's how you can see that all leading singularities are in fact residues of this, object. But the sort of remarkable thing is that every single thing that goes into building the integrand, all the operations, the BCFW operation, the analogs of the BCFW operation at loop level, correspond to simple mergings and to simple pictures involving these configurations, these projective configurations in the Grassmannian. And so, as I mentioned, so you start thinking about the life going on in terms of these objects. All right, so that's it for the basics, and so I will tell you about on Tuesday about the more recent understanding of where these things come from. Thanks a lot.
Unless everybody's hungry. It's a multiple.
Uh-huh, yes. What I think there's... if there are these kind of integrals in Gelfand's theory of hypergeometric functions, I don't know really about Gelfand, but in Gontcharov's work, thinking about polylogarithms, again, it's iterated integrals. He thinks about them as integrals in the Grassmannian, and for totally independent reasons, which will become again clear on Tuesday. He ran into exactly the same measure. So the same measure on the Grassmannian is associated with a nice way of generating polylogs. Now it's very tantalizing to think that those polylogs are somehow related to the polylogs we want for the amplitudes. But normally we think about the loop integrals as living in spacetime, and these are integrals inside the Grassmannian. And well, that's one of the things that's sort of ongoing now, is we're starting to learn how to think about the loop integrand as an integral inside the Grassmannian, actually. And so if that, it's still preliminary, but if that goes somewhere, then I really think it's, what it should do is make contact with a story like that. At least we're not going to have a, if there is going to be any contact with a story like that, we have to have a more coherent picture where we're not doing the loop integrals in space-time and the rest of it in the Grassmannian. It should be more, it should be a little more coherent. But this way of thinking about it in terms of this way of thinking about it in terms of configurations really suggests a picture for the loop integrals, which you can either think of it as an integral over momentum in space-time or in momentum space or in momentum twister space, or you can think of it as ways of orienting a lower Grassmannian inside a bigger one. And I suspect the second point of view will, I hope it'll lead somewhere fruitful.
Okay, so I think we're already running late, so let's break now. But I think in order to have enough time for lunch, let's push the next talk.